Welcome to the debate. So, imagine trying to build a microscopic brick wall in like a fraction of a second.
Right, while the ground beneath you is literally freezing rapidly.
Exactly. Do you carefully lay each brick perfectly to minimize the stress on the foundation? Or do you just furiously copy the exact same pattern over and over, you know, just to get the job done before the temperature drops too low?
It's a desperate situation, thermodynamically speaking.
It is. And that is the exact microscopic battle happening inside high-strength steel weld deposits. Today, we are looking at a highly organized microstructural component known as acicular ferrite.
Yeah, and acicular ferrite is, well, it's the crucial element that keeps critical infrastructure standing. It's vital.
Right. When this specific type of ferrite nucleates intragranularly, meaning, you know, it forms inside the individual grains of the steel rather than at their edges, it creates this incredibly chaotic-seeming interlocking structure.
It looks like a microscopic basket weave, really.
Exactly, a basket weave. And that interlocking nature acts as a vital shock absorber. It forces propagating cracks to constantly change direction, which dramatically improves the toughness of the weld deposit.
But when we look closely at these adjacent plates of acicular ferrite under an electron microscope, we encounter a fundamental controversy, one that really divides metallurgists.
Oh, deeply.
These adjacent plates exhibit a striking, undeniable tendency to share a very similar crystallographic orientation in space. I mean, they align.
They do align, yes.
So the central question we are exploring today is the mechanism behind this alignment. Does this striking organization occur simply because of the rigid, pre-existing crystallographic rules of the parent austenite crystal? Or is it driven by an active kinetic process where one plate essentially, well, sympathetically, stimulates the birth of the next?
Basically, it comes down to a fundamental question of what truly dictates the architecture of metallic materials. Is it rigid geometric law or, you know, the path of least kinetic resistance?
Right. And my position is that this alignment is a strict mathematical reflection of the austenite-ferrite orientation relationship. It's governed entirely by the physical and thermodynamic limits of the parent crystal.
The parent dictates the geometry. And the ferrite just obeys?
Yes, the ferrite simply obeys.
Well, I will argue that statistical probabilities prove dynamic kinetic factors, specifically sympathetic nucleation, are the true active drivers here. The plates are actively clustering to bypass the severe energy constraints of a rapidly cooling system.
I mean, to understand why I argue for crystallographic inevitability, we have to look at how acicular ferrite actually forms on an atomic level.
Sure.
As the weld cools, the temperature drops rapidly. At these lower temperatures, the processes that involved atoms slowly diffusing, what we call reconstructive diffusion, they basically become kinetically frozen out.
They just don't have the energy.
Right. The atoms simply do not have the thermal energy to wander around and find new, comfortable positions. Instead, what is thermodynamically favored is a displacive transformation.
Where they move all at once.
Exactly. The atoms move in a highly coordinated, military-like fashion. They shear collectively into their new structure.
A collective, synchronized shift of the atomic lattice, but one with severe structural consequences.
Immense structural consequences. Because the atoms shift together in this military formation, it creates macroscopic displacements. It produces an invariant plane strain shape deformation.
Which is a mouthful, but yes.
It is. If you're listening to this and picturing what that means physically, just imagine taking a deck of cards and pushing the top card so the whole deck slants.
Like a shear?
Right, a shear. The planes remain flat, but the shape changes. Because of this massive shape change, the morphology of the ferrite is utterly enslaved to the parent austenite's geometry.
Enslaved is a strong word, but okay.
It has to be. It must minimize the strain energy it introduces into that parent lattice. Therefore, the ferrite is forced to strictly follow established geometric rules, specifically the Kurjumov-Sachs or Nishiyama-Wasserman orientation relationships within the bean region.
So you're saying the alignment is just geometry?
Exactly. The clustering we see, where adjacent plates have similar orientations, isn't some active signaling between plates. It is a reflection of these rigid thermodynamics constraints. The parent austenite sets the furrow, and the ferrite must grow within it.
I come at it from a different way. I acknowledge the displacive nature of the transformation. I mean, the invariant plane strain is a real physical parameter that causes severe stress in the lattice.
Huge stress, yes.
But we have to look at the mathematics of those very rules you just cited. Let's take the Kurjumov-Sachs relationship. Even under those incredibly rigid mathematical rules, there are 24 crystallographically equivalent variants.
Yes, 24 variants.
That means when a newly forming plate is nucleating, it has 24 completely different equally valid orientations it could choose while still perfectly obeying the strict geometric laws of the parent austenite.
Right, theoretically.
So if structural crystallography alone were the sole driver, probability dictates that only about one quarter of adjacent plates would end up aligning similarly just by pure chance.
But you are assuming an equal probability of all 24 variants, which completely ignores how strain fields interact.
No, I am looking at the vast statistical gulf between theory and reality. The empirical data shows a vastly higher proportion of alignment than the 25% predicted by equal probability.
It's not a random distribution, I agree.
It isn't a slight deviation either. It is a massive statistical anomaly. You cannot explain away that magnitude of clustering with pure structural geometry alone. The dominant driving force must be kinetic.
You're talking about sympathetic nucleation.
I am talking about sympathetic nucleation. The formation of the first plate of acicular ferrite fundamentally alters the local environment.
In what way?
It creates an interface that makes it kinetically easier, meaning it requires significantly less activation energy for a neighboring plate to form in the exact same orientation. The first plate effectively acts as a catalyst, stamping out a kinetic copy of itself.
But your statistical argument ignores the actual birthplace of these plates. The foundation of this entire process begins with the inclusions.
The inclusions? Actually, they highlight a fundamental paradox in your purely structural view.
How so?
Acicular ferrite does not form out of thin air. It nucleates heterogeneously. In high-strength weld deposits, those essential nucleation sites are non-metallic inclusions.
Right, oxides and silicates.
Exactly. And these inclusions form while the steel is still in a liquid state. Because they are floating and tumbling in a liquid, they become trapped in completely random spatial orientations as the surrounding austenite solidifies.
They're just trapped in the matrix?
Yes. They have absolutely no crystallographic orientation relationship with the parent austenite.
Well, they are largely spherical or randomly shaped ceramic impurities trapped in the matrix.
So consider the physical reality here. The foundation, the inclusion, is sitting in a completely random spatial orientation. Therefore, the ferrite nucleating on the surface of that inclusion should theoretically project outward into the grain in a random manner.
That assumes the inclusion dictates the growth direction.
The starting points are chaotic, yet the final microstructure we observe is highly ordered. Adjacent plates align beautifully.
They do.
This strongly implies that an active cluster-forming kinetic mechanism is sweeping through the material, completely overriding those chaotic starting points. The sympathetic nucleation cascade makes the randomness of the inclusions entirely irrelevant.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. You are placing entirely too much authority on the inclusion.
It's the nucleation site.
It is, but I want you to imagine a vast, strictly plowed agricultural field. That field represents our parent austenite, and the deep, rigid furrows are the crystallographic planes dictated by the invariant plane strain.
Okay, an agricultural metaphor doesn't really capture the immense pressure of atomic displacement, but please continue.
It captures the restriction of growth. Now, take a handful of seeds, our randomly oriented non-metallic inclusions, and scatter them arbitrarily across the field.
Randomly scattered, sure.
It does not matter how those seeds land or what angle they rest at in the soil. When the crops, the acicular ferrite plates, begin to grow, they are physically incapable of growing in any direction other than along the rigid, pre-existing furrows dictated by the parent field.
But they still have to start somewhere.
They do, but the orientation relationship is always, without exception, with the parent austenite, never with the inclusion. The inclusion simply provides the heterogeneous surface required to lower the initial energy barrier for nucleation.
So it's just a catalyst.
It is a starting gun, nothing more. Furthermore, as these plates grow along the furrows, their military-like atomic shifting generates intense strain energy in the surrounding lattice.
Right, the invariant plane strain again.
Yes. To minimize that energy, the system naturally favors the formation of mutually accommodating variants. We see this exact same structural necessity driving the autocatalytic bursts in Martensitic transformations.
But that's different.
The alignment isn't the plates actively copying each other to save time. It's the parent field forcing them into the only structurally viable arrangement to prevent the lattice from basically tearing itself apart.
Look, if we examine the actual measurements of the harvest from your field, the transmission electron microscopy data, your analogy fractures.
Does it?
Yes. If the field's furrows and the need to accommodate strain truly dictate the growth, the empirical data should show a distribution of variants that merely fit together to relieve pressure, rather than simply duplicating each other identically.
Actually, the empirical data theorously supports the crystallographical model, provided you look at how carefully it had to be extracted. Measuring these precise alignments is notoriously difficult.
Because of the dislocation density, sure.
Exactly. Acicular ferrite has an exceptionally high dislocation density. The crystal lattice is absolutely packed with microscopic line defects caused by the violent shearing of the displacive transformation.
It's a very messy structure.
It is. Because of this heavy deformation, traditional measurement techniques in an electron microscope, like relying on Kikuchi lines, simply fail. The patterns are too diffuse and blurry to read accurately.
Which is exactly why researchers had to look beyond standard diffraction methods to see what was actually happening between the plates.
Right. They utilized a highly rigorous methodology analyzing reciprocal lattice vectors from selected area electron diffraction patterns.
SAED patterns, yes.
And they did this using a Philips EM400T transmission electron microscope, operated at 120 kilovolts.
That specific voltage is critical for penetrating heavily defected steel samples.
It's the only way to achieve the necessary precision. By operating at 120 kilovolts, they achieved an estimated error margin of less than 5 degrees.
So the measurements are accurate. I'm not disputing that.
We are not guessing at these alignments. When you look at the results in Table 2 of the foundational source material, the evidence is stark. The adjacent plates consistently exhibit axis angle pairs that are incredibly close to 180 degrees, about the 001 or 011 crystallographic axes.
Okay, but
this is not a random cascade of kinetic clustering. This precisely matches the fundamental symmetry operations of the body-centered cubic structure. More importantly, it perfectly aligns with specific variants like 2B, 5B, and 6A of the Kerzhimov-Sachs orientation relationship.
Right.
The mathematical symmetry of the crystal predicts the exact physical reality we observe under the microscope.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why.
All right.
You are pointing to the presence of variants 2B, 5B, and 6A as a victory for rigid crystallography, while completely ignoring the obvious omissions in your own data set.
Omissions?
As we established earlier, there are 24 mathematical possibilities calculated for the Kerzhimov-Sachs relationship. If the austenite's furrows dictate the rules equally, and the goal is simply to minimize strain, why does the TEM data overwhelmingly skew toward just a handful of similarly oriented variants?
Because certain combinations of variants better accommodate the complex strain fields generated in three-dimensional space.
But look closely at the specific anomalies in the data. Look at pair 14 in the analysis.
Okay.
That shows an axis angle pair of 34.2 degrees about a specific axis, which is extremely close to a sigma 9 coincident site lattice orientation.
Yes, the sigma boundaries.
Then look at pair 13, which is essentially a sigma 3 twin relation. If you were listening to this and wondering what a sigma boundary is, imagine two crystal lattices meeting and perfectly sharing a fraction of their atoms.
It's a highly structured boundary.
Right. In a sigma 3 boundary, one out of every three atoms matches perfectly between the two plates. It is an incredibly low energy boundary.
which perfectly supports a thermodynamic argument. The system seeks a low-energy state.
But think about the macroscopic physics of the strain accommodation you championed earlier. If this process were purely about minimizing strain energy via shape-change accommodation, like a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle fitting together to relieve pressure, adjacent variants should have fundamentally different shape deformations.
To cancel each other out.
Exactly. They should operate on different habit planes so that one plate's expansion cancels out the adjacent plate's contraction. The fact that we consistently see plates forming sigma-3 twins or identical orientations proves that they are not canceling out macroscopic stress.
You think they're adding to it? They are compounding it. Therefore, something else is overriding the need for strain accommodation. Sympathetic nucleation is kinetically favoring identical alignments because the energy saved by avoiding a new nucleation event is far greater than the energy penalty of the accumulating strain.
So it's a trade-off.
Yes. The system isn't trying to cancel out strain. It's finding a kinetic loophole to rapidly propagate the phase change.
That's an interesting point, though I would frame it differently. To understand why those specific low-energy boundaries appear and why the system seems to tolerate compounding strain, we have to look at the temporal and energetic boundaries of the entire transformation.
You're talking about the incomplete reaction phenomenon.
I am. We must discuss the incomplete reaction phenomenon.
The classic thermodynamic roadblock of all displacive transformations.
Exactly. It is the ultimate proof of thermodynamic control. A acicular ferrite transformation does not just continue happily until the liquid or the austenite is fully transformed.
No, it doesn't.
It is well documented that the transformation actively ceases before the residual austenite reaches its equilibrium composition. It stops short.
It leaves untransformed austenite behind?
Right, which is a critical physical barrier. It proves that the transformation is fiercely bounded by thermodynamic limits, not driven by runaway kinetic clustering.
How does that disprove kinetics?
Because if sympathetic nucleation were the dominant force, if plates were just endlessly and easily stamping out low-energy copies of themselves via sigma-3 boundaries, the reaction wouldn't halt so prematurely.
The strain gets too high.
Yes. The strict invariant Klein strain deformation restricts the movement of atoms so severely that as the plates grow, the accumulated strain energy in the surrounding austenite skyrockets. Eventually, that strain energy becomes so massive that it thermodynamically chokes off any further transformation.
It hits a wall.
The reaction stops because the rigid crystallographic rules say the energy budget is entirely spent.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered that the incomplete reaction phenomenon actually proves the kinetic argument?
Wait, a reaction halting due to thermodynamic exhaustion proves kinetics?
Yes, precisely because of how it must behave before it hits that wall. The incomplete reaction shows us a system that is desperately racing against the clock.
I mean, it's cooling rapidly, sure.
Because the thermodynamic conditions are so restrictive, and because reconstructive diffusion is entirely frozen out at these lower temperatures, the system relies exclusively on kinetic shortcuts to achieve any transformation at all before the energy budget runs out.
And you view sympathetic nucleation as that shortcut.
Sympathetic nucleation is the ultimate kinetic shortcut. We aren't just looking at abstract math and angle pairs. At low magnifications, we can physically see these plates growing in dense, localized clusters radiating outward.
Radiating outward from the initial inclusion, though.
But propagating plate to plate. When one plate forms, it creates an active interface. The easiest, most energy-efficient kinetic path forward for a heavily constrained system isn't to wander off and nucleate a brand new, differently oriented plate on another random inclusion.
That would require a lot of activation energy.
Exactly. That requires massive activation energy. The easiest path is to use the existing interface as a springboard. It stamps out another plate in the exact same orientation, right next to the first one, generating those sigma-3 boundaries we discussed.
Even though it compounds the strain.
Yes. It might compound the macroscopic strain, bringing the incomplete reaction closer to halting, but kinetically, it is the only way the transformation can proceed at that rapid cooling rate.
But, that springboard still requires the parent austenite to mathematically allow that specific orientation to exist in that exact location.
Look, I am not claiming the austenite rules disappear. I am demonstrating that they are entirely insufficient to explain the clustering.
They're a prerequisite, not the driver.
Right.
The incomplete reaction proves the system is under extreme duress. In a race where your energy is rapidly depleting, you take the path of least kinetic resistance. You copy-paste the variant that just successfully formed. That is sympathetic nucleation in action, overriding the theoretical distribution of crystallographic variants.
I think the line between our frameworks is incredibly sharp here, and we should probably summarize where we stand based on the material.
Sure.
For me, the foundational architecture of the well deposit simply cannot be ignored, nor can it be overridden by localized kinetic shortcuts. The 180-degree rotation symmetries we discussed, the strict adherence to the Nishiyama-Wasserman model with its 12 variants, and the Kurjumov-Sachs model with its 24 variants.
The geometry of it all.
Right. These are not mere mathematical coincidences that the material occasionally stumbles into. The sophisticated TEM data, utilizing reciprocal lattice vectors to bypass the immense dislocation density, proves that the parent austenite dictates the spatial destiny of the ferrite.
But it doesn't explain the frequency.
It is a displacive transformation. It is a military-like movement of atoms that must respect the physical boundaries and strain limits of its parent lattice. Crystallography is the ultimate law. The clustering we see is merely the system finding the most thermodynamically stable way to satisfy those rigid pre-existing geometric laws.
Well, my summary is that while crystallography undoubtedly provides the theoretical menu of options, sympathetic nucleation kinetics makes the actual physical choice.
The menu versus the meal.
Exactly. We cannot ignore the stark statistical reality of the microstructure. When the math says adjacent plates should only align 25% of the time by pure chance, but the physical reality shows a massively higher proportion of identical orientations, we must acknowledge an active driving mechanism.
The kinetics?
Yes. The presence of specific sigma-3 twin relations and sigma-9 orientations proves that these plates are not just passively accommodating strain to satisfy the austenite. If they were, they would choose different variants to cancel out the stress.
Instead of stacking it.
Right. Instead, they are actively stimulating one another, utilizing shared interfaces to form identical orientations to rapidly bypass the heavy kinetic constraints of a frozen system.
Well, it is clear that the true nature of displacive transformations in high-strength steel likely relies on an incredibly delicate, still somewhat unresolved tension between the rigid mathematical symmetry of crystallography and the dynamic, highly opportunistic nature of kinetics.
Oh, absolutely. It underscores exactly why we must apply multiple frameworks, both structural geometry and statistical kinetics, to truly interpret these complex metallurgical phenomena. Relying on a single lens will obscure the reality of how these materials actually form.
It brings us back to where we started, really. When you pour that liquid metal and watch it freeze, the final microscopic structure isn't chaotic, but it isn't a simple pre-drawn blueprint either.
No, it's not.
It is a fierce negotiation between the absolute rules of space and the desperate race against time. We will leave it to you, the listener, to weigh the evidence and decide which force truly commands the structure. Thank you for joining us on The Debate.